Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today we're excited to have Alexander Levitt. Alexander's goal is to prepare organizations and their employees to be competitive and marketable in the future business world. A former nationally syndicated columnist for the Wall Street Journal and writer for the New York Times, Fast Company, and Forbes, Alexander has authored several books, including Humanity Works, Merging People and Technologies for the Workplace of the Future. We featured that this month in our newsletter. Alexandra's recently became a partner with organization development firm People Results. She consults and writes on leadership development, human resources, technology adoption, entrepreneurship, innovation, career, and workplace trends on behalf of numerous Fortune 500 companies, including American Express, Canon, Deloitte, Intuit, Silk Road, and Staples. She's also a frequent national media spokesperson and was named an American Management Association top leader 2 years in a row, and has also been Money Magazine's Online Career Expert of the Year and the author of one of Forbes' best websites for women. Most recently, she was named to the International Global Ranking of Business Thought Leaders, Thinkers 50 2019. Congratulations, because that's not easy to do. A member of the Northwestern University Council of 100 and the Young Entrepreneur Council, Alexandra received the prestigious Emerging Leader Award from her alma mater. The award honors a Northwestern graduate under 35 who has made a significant impact in her field and in society. I guess she just gave away your age. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
That was a couple of years ago, though.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thanks so much for being with us. I truly appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to our conversation about the future of the workplace, and including about a lot about robots, so we're really going to get into that.
You are very welcome. It is great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Her website is Alexandra Levitt, that's AlexandraLevitt.com, and Twitter is A-Levitt, A-L-E-V-I-T. And as I said, this is part of a series this year on AI and society. We're talking about ethics, we're talking about robots, we're talking about many things. So do tell your colleagues about this series. We do a different theme every year. So we're really excited about this, and we've had some great speakers and guests. So I'm really excited to have you with us. And as I always do, I start out, I gave your bio and read it. So I want you to tell me a little bit about your personal journey and how you began your career as a futurist. It's very interesting. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, thanks, Sue. I'm glad you asked, because this is a little bit of a backstory to how I became a futurist. You've got the official credentials. We went over those.
Right.
But there is, of course, a story behind the story. And this one, is a little bit more interesting than how I got into some of my other work. But this actually starts way back in 1988. And now I really will review my reveal my real age, which is I was 12 years old in 1988, so that can tell you. And I was growing up in Washington, D.C., down the street from the headquarters of the World Future Society. And back then, my dad and I were really into sci-fi. My dad was partial to Star Trek, as many people in his generation were. I was into the Ender's Game series, which I don't know if listeners are familiar with that, but it's a series by Orson Scott Card where basically children save the world by going into space and fighting aliens, so that was kind of fun. And we decided to take a tour of the World Future Society. So we went there, and they showed us their ideas of what they thought society would be like around now, so around 2019, 2020. And there was this one device, I'll never forget, it was called Interactive Television. And the idea was you would have it, everyone would have their own machine. It would be in the palm of your hand, and you'd be able to push a button, and instantaneously you would be able to hear the Cosby Show episode that you would miss on Thursday night. You could push another button, you'd be able to hear the new Madonna single that back then we had to have the radio play it, and then if we were lucky, we would catch it and be able to tape it. It was real pain. So this was what this technology was all about. And if you think about it, it was entertainment on demand way back then. And I was just intrigued by this. And if you think about it, this technology was the precursor for the technology that we all have sitting within a foot of our person, the smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just absolutely smitten with this idea that you could make if not predictions, we tend to not call them predictions, but forecasts about where things are going, what's most likely to cause a disruption, what's percolating up through the marketplace. So even at the age of 12, I was interested in this. And then way later, if you fast forward a bunch of years, I got started in the workforce space because I had had some early problems getting ahead in my corporate career. Wrote a book called They Don't Teach Corporate in College for young professionals who were starting to try to make their mark in the business world. And much to my pleasure and surprise, that book did well and led to a whole new career as, at the time, was a 20-something workplace author, speaker, and consultant. And as I went through a few years of that, people started asking me, well, you know, the 20-somethings now are a huge generation because I was mostly speaking to the millennials and people who care about the millennials. Well, what do you think is going to happen next with the 20-somethings? And this just naturally became something I was constantly answering. And fortunately for me, I was a little, you know, I was somewhat accurate in my forecast on what the millennials were going to be like, both as mid-level professionals, as leaders, et cetera. And that was when I got back into the futurist space. So it came full circle from my initial interest way back in 1988 to my interest currently, which resulted kind of directly from being asked, what do I see happening next in the workforce? And I just had a blast learning from other people. There have been so many smart experts on this topic, and I'm sure we're going to get into the nitty-gritty, but that's how I got my start. And it's funny how the world works sometimes, how the universe works.
We did the
things that were originally interesting, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I have a 13-year-old, so it's interesting how I notice, like, when I take him places now, like, I wonder how that'll affect him in the future. So I think your story hits home for me, and I'm sure it hits home for other people too. So let's talk about some of these trends. You know, those of us who are coaches, there's a lot of different people on the call. You've got coaches on the call, consultants, and you've got people inside business, managers and executives. And mostly, obviously, because where we are, it's mostly tech. But tell us a little bit about how you see, let's talk about the workplace particularly. I mean, how far out are we talking about here? I know you don't use the word prediction, but are you forecasting? Talking 20 years, 40 years?
This is a really, really good question also.
Yeah.
Because I make it a point to talk about 2030 specifically. And the reason that I talk about 2030, it was only about 10 years from now, is because I think we're bumping up against what is known as the technological singularity. And what that means is it's a time in society when artificial intelligence will become so advanced that we can't recognize our world as we know it today. So many of us in the futurist space think it's futile to forecast too far in the future, because at the time that the technological singularity occurs, all bets are off. Nobody has any idea what's going to happen. And some people, I should probably point out, think that the technological singularity has already happened with the Internet. But I don't think that's true. I still think our society is recognizable to someone who was living in 1950. Yes, they would be blown away by the Internet, but it's not that inherently our society is completely transformed, which is what's going to happen when artificial intelligence reaches a certain level. And if you look at the statistics behind how rapidly it's advancing, it is going to happen at some point the first half of this century, probably. And that's why I think it's kind of dicey for me to make forecasts based on what we're currently seeing. But I feel pretty comfortable that I can forecast at least up to 2030, and possibly, if this doesn't happen sooner rather than later, beyond that. But I think, believe me, most companies aren't even thinking in the next 3 years, let alone for 2030.
Right. Well, right.
So
exactly.
I think they're pretty safe.
So you mentioned singularity. I mean, I understand what that is, but I think it'd be good for you to explain in terms of AI terms, like what singularity is, and so it kind of explains three types of AI so people understand that. I've done this every time on the call, so I think it's important people understand the different types of AI. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, the singularity isn't a form of AI in and of itself. It's just a way of explaining that AI will advance in terms of its cognition, in terms of its ability to replicate human behaviors and emotions. So it will become either as advanced or skilled as humans, or what many people fear, which I don't think it's universally frightening necessarily, but they will grow beyond human capabilities in many respects,
right,
and take on a role in our society, which we can't even imagine what that might be, because we don't know what they're going to do, what they're going to be able to do. So that's all the singularity means, is that could be coming. It's not a form of AI in and of itself. It's more of a concept, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
a concept.
Right. And just to repeat, that singularity means that basically artificial intelligence can replicate humans as we are now.
Yeah, it's the moment in which technology will advance to a certain point that we can't recognize our society. So think about the singularity. It's a point in time. It's kind of like when, you know, if you look at it as, and I don't need to get religious or anything, but if you look about when, you know, Jesus came about in ancient Rome, when he came on the scene, like that was a point in time that the world transformed and a different religion was birthed, and it affected the Roman Empire, and it affected kind of everything else that was going on in civilization at the time. So that's not a technological singularity, but it's sort of a singularity source in that once he came on the scene, like nothing was ever the same from then on. So that's kind of one comparison, and I love it when I'm on a show and I make an analogy that I've never made before. But I have literally never said that before. And I'm not necessarily calling myself a Christian or anything like that, but I think that's a good way of looking at it. It's a point in time, and then everything's going to be different after that.
Okay. So that's a little – okay, so I understand that. So what I'm relating it to is the idea that I'm going to put it back to AI terms here, because I do want to talk a little bit about the different types of AI. So mm-hmm. Narrow, general, super. So when you're talking about singularity, to me, I think of general AI, where a human, a robot or a machine can replicate what humans do. We're not close to that yet, but we have narrow AI, which certainly things can be replicated, certain things like they can play chess better and they can automate better and they can do algorithms better. I mean, but Google obviously has been, you know, a machine learning apparatus for years, and that is a form mm-hmm. of AI. A narrow form of AI. So I think I think that it's interesting because people are thinking this is all of a sudden happening. It's like, no. We've been having artificial intelligence and machine learning for a long, long time. We just haven't really called it that.
That's true.
And, yeah. So how do you see – okay, so let's talk about singularity. So how do you see – let's just talk about 20 to 30 years from now – things in the workplace. This is we can say about the world, but let's just talk about the workplace right now. How do you see things? Like, what are the trends that you would see in let's say 25 years? Let's call it that.
Well, I kind of make it a point not to forecast that far, but I would have to say if things are progressing at the current rate, then we will see fully integrated human-machine hybrid teams, meaning humans and machines mm-hmm. are working side by side together. They have many of the same abilities. I think we'll see a lot of integration, not just of the team itself, but in a human being, you're going to see a lot of artificial intelligence embedded in that person. So right now we have, for example, just a very rudimentary idea. People will have maybe an artificial leg or an artificial foot, mm-hmm. or they've lost a hand, so they have an artificial hand. Well, we're going to have implants for the brain that allow the brain to kind of be this hybrid in and of itself of artificial and natural intelligence. And so one can only imagine what that will mean in terms of productivity, in terms of what tasks we're going to choose to do as humans, what we're going to leave specifically to artificial intelligence, to robots or machines. And I think that's part of where it's going to get murky, is that where are we going to draw the line between what is a machine and what is a human? I think that's going to be increasingly difficult to do as we get beyond 2030. But I do see that humans will always have a role to play, because until machines develop consciousness or develop really the full spectrum of human emotion, which is a long time away, or maybe not super long, but beyond 2030 for sure, it's going to be hard for the machine to fully take over. And I love to use the example in trying to explain this of where we've tried to automate things and it's kind of gone awry. There's actually two examples I'm going to share. The mm-hmm. first one is something that happened here in the States, and probably most people on the call today remember it. It was only about 2 years ago. but United Airlines had an algorithm that was telling them when they had to pull passengers off a plane because staffers, so flight attendants or pilots or, you know, even people who just needed to move from one place to another, could get where they needed to go without the business losing money. And so what happened was there was this one particular flight going out of O'Hare where they recognized they had to get, the algorithm was telling them, you have to get these two flight attendants to New York. They must go to New York. They must get there tonight. Do whatever you have to do to get those passengers off so that we have seats for these flight attendants. And what happened was everybody at United Airlines just stood kind of idly by and watched as this algorithm told them, well, we're not going to be profitable unless we pull these people off. And they forcibly removed somebody from an airplane that did not want to go, and
right,
he was injured in the process.
Big news, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was huge news, and it's like, this is the danger. We have to have what's called the human in the loop. It refers to, yes, we listen to our machines, yes, they're smart, yes, we automate something. Humans have the unique ability to stand by and say, well, that may be an impact on profitability, but what about our brand reputation? What about the ethical, moral
that was not that hard.
Yeah, but they didn't do it. They were just like, well,
I know, the algorithm said,
and this is the danger. So that's one thing.
Yeah, so you said you got another one, yep.
Yeah, so there's another example of this. So Japan had a major nursing shortage a few years ago, and so they thought, oh, no problem, we've got robots that can do nursing functions. So they worked with a company, the Sumitomo Ricoh company, and they developed this six-foot-tall robot called RoBear, and it was a robot nurse, and they thought that it could just take over for all these human nurses that they were missing. And what they learned the hard way was that RoBear could really only move people in and out of bed, maybe serve them some meals. In fact, human nurses do a whole lot more than that. They're able to come into a crisis situation and immediately be able to assemble the complex mix of specialists who are needed on the scene based on what they've experienced in their prior career. They're able to ascertain the level of pain that a patient is in just by looking at them for a few seconds. They're able to sit down with a relative who has just gotten a difficult diagnosis and be able to react with empathy and explain what that means in a way that makes the relative feel a little better. These are things that we're not even close to having a robot be able to do. And so Japan learned, guess what? We can't automate nursing. And there are so many professions like that. Almost every profession is like that right now. So that's an area where...
I just wanted you to finish. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, and so this is... These are just really salient examples of why robots are in the near future aren't going to be able to take over human jobs. And so when people get hysterical and there's a lot of hand-wringing around this, you have to point this stuff out, but in most professions there are a lot of human elements that are still going to need to be completed. In fact, if you look at the stats behind this, if you don't believe my examples, you can just look at the research. McKinsey Global Institute, their latest report, which was released in 2018, showed that about 60% of all current human occupations on a global level will be affected by automation in the next 10 years. But of those 60%, so if you fall into that 60%, only about 30% of your tasks will be automated, meaning that even if you fall into that 60%, you still have got two-thirds of your job that you're going to have to do. It just means that for that other 30%, great, maybe it's become easier, maybe you can free yourself up to do more strategic work, or maybe you need to look at ways where you can be more marketable and develop new skills so that you can fill your day. But either way, it doesn't mean that you don't have a job. And
yeah,
that's
like that kind of just silenced people a little bit. You know, like it's been so much bad PR about robots. You know, just,
yes, definitely.
What about automated cars? Would you say that would be put into the category of kind of automation going awry a little bit?
Self-driving cars, is that what you said?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, so self-driving cars, it's a good example, kind of like interactive television in a way. So going back to interactive television, the technology was there in the 80s, and then it just didn't have a societal uptake. I sense that where we're going with self-driving vehicles is similar in that we don't have the infrastructure in place to really make this happen. And the countries that I think would be most amenable to self-driving vehicles, i.e. the UK and the Netherlands, which tend to be very forward-thinking, have the worst infrastructures. And if you've ever been to London, if you've seen those streets, I think it's just a very complex environment in which to launch a self-driving car. And here in the U.S., we're just going to have regulations upon regulations. I think it's going to get mired in, you know, no one will be able to decide on safety standards, and there's just going to be a lot of discussion for a really long time. So the technology's there. I just think that it's not going to happen mostly because we're going to get in our own way with it. And I do think it's complex. I used to say, and I'll admit when one of my forecasts needs to be adjusted a little bit, about 5 years ago I would have said on this point that my son, who is 11, would learn to drive a normal vehicle. And my daughter, who is 8, would learn to drive both. Because I thought at some point in there would be the kind of the mass consumption of these self-driving vehicles. And now I'm adjusting that a bit to say I think they will both learn to drive regular cars. I don't think self-driving vehicles will reach the masses by that time. What I will say about self-driving vehicles, though, is even though not everybody's going to be using them, I do think supply chain is going to be affected by this. So trucking and having trucks that drive themselves in formation from one place to another, I see that happening more quickly, perhaps in the next few years, than I do like every human family is going to have a self-driving car. So I think it's going to affect enterprise and supply chain first, and then gradually at some point, hopefully, it will become available to the rest of us.
Why do you hope it becomes available?
I think it's another thing that makes people's lives easier. It's just like kind of riding in an Uber or riding in a Lyft. Like, you can do other things while your car is on the road. Hopefully, by the time it gets rolled out, it will actually prevent human error-related accidents as opposed to causing more accidents. And
right.
I think that's where some of the safety standards are going to come into play. But I feel pretty comfortable that this isn't going to have mass uptake until it's been ironed out a bit. And that's why I think it's going to take longer than I initially would have guessed.
PR issue. I mean, obviously, once there's a mistake, it's just so obvious. Like, if someone dies or something like that, it's sort of like drugs. Like, if they're doing the testing, like, you know, a bunch of people die from it, it's just like, it's, you know, it's a huge, huge PR problem. So I think that, all I care about is, can someone do the calendaring? Go back to the calendaring. Can we just have one big calendar? It would be really, really great if we could. I hope that a robot can do that. I hope we're going to find not a robot, but a machine, I guess is a better word. So let's talk about the effect. I mean, the thing that I am most interested in and wanted to make sure we talk about in terms of the series is the effect, the ethics and this effect on society. I say to people these days, I say, you know, if we think that communication has been difficult with where we are now, in terms of getting people to talk to each other and to listen and the soft skills, if you will, I think it's going to even be more the case with some of these technologies. We'll be together less. We're going to rely on these. I'm concerned, you know. I'm concerned that I don't want this to be like a takeover kind of thing, right? So tell me your thoughts on that. What do you think about that?
So Sue, this is a brilliant point because I personally am also concerned about the psychological impact of technology, and there's two primary places that I'm concerned. One of them is what you just mentioned, which is that as we rely more and more on technology, our interpersonal skills suffer. In fact, we're already seeing this with our kids' generation, with the ones that are on the older side that just entered the workforce last year. They are the oldest members of Generation Z, which was born roughly from 1996 to 2012. And what we're seeing with Generation Z is that they are the first generation to have been raised on technology, and they have never, many of them, have never dealt with delicate interpersonal situations because they've just done everything online. It started with instant messenger for them, email, then it moved to text. And so when I'm in front of an audience of Gen Zers, because I'll still go in and train them on what they need to do to be successful in the workforce, I'll always ask the question, how many of you have broken up with someone via text message? And at least 75% of them raise their hands. And so they've never actually had a conversation.
Break up versus text message? What?
Break
really?
Up, yeah.
Somebody, so this generation, oh my gosh, so this generation Z, which is 1996 to 2012, 75% raise their hand that they've broken up with someone via text message.
Yeah, I mean,
that was
an anecdotal thing that I just do in my talk. But,
no, I know.
But,
I just want to make sure
I'm
right.
I mean, it's insane.
Oh my God.
Because what it means is they run into
bad.
A troublesome boss in the workplace, and they have no idea how to handle it. They don't know how to go into somebody's office and sit down and resolve a conflict. They do not know. I also see, this is referring also to what you're talking about, a lot of loneliness, a lot of alienation, because people look at others online and think, their world is great and mine stinks. And by the way, the only way that I ever communicate with people is through text. I never actually have conversations or see people in person. And we are social beings. This doesn't work for humans. So we're going to have to see ourselves backpedal a little bit. I see, and we're already actually seeing this happen. This is a forecast I made that I'm seeing come to fruition already, which is around the return to basic values, because I'm seeing this talk about soft skills exploding now. Whereas 5 years ago, no one cared. It was all about tech skills. And now it's all about soft skills. And it's because nobody has them or the younger population doesn't have them. We realize we can't add human value without them. And then the other thing that I'm concerned about, the other psychological thing, is the growth of contract workers and the gig economy. Because the fact of the matter is, human business has been working the way it's been working, meaning with people working for a larger organization, for about the last 150 years, we are not as a society set up for a large number of people to work for themselves. And I think a lot of people aren't cut out for that kind of work either, for the diligence and the self-marketing and the agility that's required to really make your own destiny. And I'm very concerned about the people who have just rested on their laurels, they've worked for a company, that's what they're used to doing, and then they're thrust out into the world of contract work where they've got to eat what they kill. I'm very, very concerned for these people because I think it's going to be a hard transition for them. So those are the two areas where I'm concerned. But one thing I'm not concerned about is people losing their jobs. Don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about that, but let's talk about the gig economy. Well, I mean, there's a lot of things I'm going to go back to, but let's start with the gig economy. So who is this going to affect? I mean, I think that kids, so the millennials, let's call them, they're not going to care if they're in gig economy or not. So who's concerned about self-marketing? And are you talking about people that are like, you know, not baby boomers, but Xers or Ys? I mean, because they are not used to having to market themselves?
Well, actually I'm concerned about the younger people too. I'm obviously most concerned about boomers are kind of, you know, they're actually learning it on the other end because they don't want to work full time, so they've gone into the gig economy, some of them, already. It's going to be the Xers. It's going to be the older millennials. It's basically anyone who was reared in the traditional business world, which is pretty much most people that have been working up to date. Is going to be the part of this cohort affected. But also, I think what we're going to see happening more and more, I already see this happening a little bit, is college graduates are getting hired into contract positions. They are not even getting hired as a full-timer from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're going to become used to, but I still think there are going to be people who are good at this and not good at this. Similarly to working in corporate America. There are people who are cut out to work in corporate America and people who have always said, I got to go do my own thing. And those are the entrepreneurs. Well, this is kind of the reverse of that problem. And I think whether you're, just because you're 22 right now or even 18, doesn't necessarily mean you have the skills to make this work. And I think what we're going to see is just there's a lot more people in this situation than were before. Some of them will be able to make a go of it and some of them won't be. And whether they're younger or older, I think
Beside
the point.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm gonna appeal to you. You say you have an 11-year-old and 8-year-old.
Yes.
Now, so I have a 13-year-old.
Yes, now.
So, I'm not in the business of predictions, but however, I have said to a few people that I don't think that kids probably mine's 13, yours is 11, so certainly our kids may not go to college, not because they don't want to go to college. I mean, I don't think my kid's going to college, you know, just because. But I don't think that kids. These ages will be going to college as it exists right now. the college is going to be completely different. So I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think that affects the gig economy in a little bit, because I think that people are going to be getting into the workplace sooner. I don't think kids need to go. I mean, I have 3 degrees, so I'm all about college, and I love the social part about college. But as far as learning, they don't need to go to college. In fact, they can go online and learn whatever they want, and they can also even do – they can either do a cadaver. Eventually, you know, 6 years from now, they're going to be doing cadavers in virtual reality. So now, I don't think I'm too controversial saying this. And as I said, I love college for a lot of different reasons. But how if you're a liberal arts school right now, or if you're how do you convince people, kids, to go to college? Because they can just go in a dorm room and look at the class on video.
Yeah, and where we see this is a great example of where we see the technology is there, and society hasn't quite caught up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you don't need to go to college for anything anymore. You can get any skill set that you want online. You can do it much more cheaply, much more easily. And when we ask Gen Zers, I've never actually asked them, but I've seen some studies that have shown that Gen Zers don't feel like they have to go to college either. That if they're going, it's for the social bonds. It's for the network. It's not for the skill, no matter what they're thinking of doing. And there are still professions where they do require a degree, but I actually did some research with DeVry University's Career Advisory Board, which is a nonprofit that I help run, and we learned a couple years ago when we looked at this that about 80% of employers today don't really care where skills come from. They don't care if you have a college degree or if you've got a micro-credential, meaning if you get a certification from a reputable online source. As long as you can show that you are proficient in that skill and that you're competent to practice that skill in a work environment, that's good. So employers are starting to move on this, which is great, but I still think what we're likely to see in our kids, not their lifetimes, mm-hmm. but in the time frame that they are looking at college, I still think college is going to kind of have that societal perk to it, where, you know, people are still going to think, oh, but you have to go to college, you know, and it's going to get kind of be one of those things like it's not really necessary, but parents are still going to push their kids to do it. I mean, just look at the recent admissions
scandal. They're clearly paying for it too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's still got this like
it's a category.
It does.
But I just think that, you know, again, if you've got kids who are more entrepreneurial
mm-hmm.
And are more independent, I don't know what other word it means. I think that this is part of the, you know, I think all of this is tied into education. I mean, I don't think we teach kids. If we taught kids differently, they would be more entrepreneurial, and they would be able to deal with the gig economy, and they would be able to market themselves, and they
mm-hmm.
would be able to be more creative. But because we're teaching the way we teach normally, which is rote and not teaching empathy and not teaching creativity and innovation, we're kind of screwing ourselves here. If you listen to you, we know what's going to happen, but we're
mm-hmm.
not, you know, we consider and say, we, you know, we're sitting right here, like, it doesn't take too much rocket science to figure this out, but we don't have the infrastructure to figure out how we can change things in the educational system to deal with that. Whether it's robots or gig or any of this, I mean, they're kind of related in a way. I mean, it's like basically the jobs that you think you're seeking aren't going to be there in the way that they are now. And even if you
mm-hmm.
take the statistics that you gave of 60% is affected by automation, and of that 30% is still automated, it's like, well, what part of that job is not the automation part that you need to know? Well, that's
right.
Soft skills. It's mostly soft skills stuff.
Yep, and the other really important part of that is exactly what you said. It's that integration of artificial intelligence and human intelligence. It's being the person who can
mm-hmm.
read the algorithm for United Airlines and then say,
right,
the algorithm's telling us this. However, I think that we need to do this. It's otherwise known as an explainer. It's the person who goes to decision makers and says, all right, well, here's what the data's telling us, and here's what I've taken the data into consideration, and I understand how the software program came up with it, and here's what I think we should do. That is going to be a job category that does not currently exist, that is going to be necessary in every single place where a manual process has been replaced by an artificial process or an automated process. And we are not, we are not teaching our students anything about this. So it's just one example of how we're going to need to do this. But I think you're right about us not, the educational system's not moving quickly enough, particularly I would say at the university level, it's not moving quickly enough. I actually see this, and I don't know if you've experienced this too, Sue, but I've experienced in my kids' elementary education, a lot of this starting to happen. Like the flipped classroom is something that we routinely see around here, where the kid decides what they want to learn. They go and they research it online. They come back, and then they have a discussion with the teacher. The teacher is the facilitator, not the teacher. Mm-hmm. So that's
great.
That is something
is that in public school you're doing that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's great. That's great. We do. My son's in private school, and they do, you know, the word student agency, and it's the same idea, where they're, you know, it's child-centered, they're figuring out what they want to learn, and they have ARCs, things like that. It's Reggio Emilia, essentially. But it's similar. I've never heard that word flipped. I like that word. So let's see. We talked about the psychological effects of the gig economy. Let's go back to some of these skills that, I mean, I'm assuming in your consulting you're suggesting, hey, we need to teach people some of these, let's call them judgment, skills of judgment. I mean, when you're talking about being the explainer, they've got to have judgment to determine that a computer and a machine can't do, and that's the point. And they're not going to be able to do that in our lifetime, I don't believe. Not in our lifetime. Maybe, I don't even know if our kids' lifetime. And that's like, computer learning that's a long time from now. Tell us about that. Like, how do you see that emerging in terms of people learning to be explainers, people learning to have empathy, people learning to resolve conflict, things like that?
Well, it's one of those things that I think, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on who you're talking to, it's going to fall to the people manager. Because what they're going to see is, and this is why in my book Humanity Works, a huge part of it is addressing the people manager and saying, this is what you need to be helping your people learn so that your teams can be effective in the workplace of the future. And we talk a lot about these human skills like interpersonal sensitivity and judgment and intuition and problem solving and creativity, because that's where humans are going to be able to add value in the workplace of the future. I mean, not only is it essential to making sure machines don't screw everything up, but it's also where we can provide a unique contribution that machines are at the moment incapable of providing. And so what we're seeing happening, though, is that the people manager is getting these entry-level professionals, college graduates, who have these skills in even lesser amounts than previous generations. And they're having to be taught kind of the hard way by making mistakes and having to go back to the drawing board with addressing a problematic situation or working out a coworker conflict, something as simple as that. And here's another danger. I don't mean to be like all doom and gloom on this call. I hope it's clear that I'm overall pretty optimistic about the future of work, but I do get worried about remote work. Not for people who have been working a while. I think, you know, flex work, remote work, cool for people who have actually worked in real work environments, in-person work environments, but I get very nervous about kids who have never had a job before being thrown into I can work from home or I can work from wherever, and I'm going to be completely isolated and rely 100% on technology to communicate and collaborate with other human beings. I think that is a tough nut, and no one is going to learn what they need to do in an environment like that. So you've got to get these entry-level people, and you've got to have them in some way in an in-person environment, at least for their first year, and then you can do what you want. But I see this being a trend where all of a sudden we've got 100% flex work, you just graduated, now you're working from home, and you do not know how to engage in a business environment.
One of the things that is probably I don't think it's necessarily a surprise, as I understand looking back on it, it makes sense. But when I was working at Cisco 4 years ago, there's all these predictions around, and I was a consultant at that point, all these predictions about remote workers and how in virtuality and how, you know, there was, we were going to see people were preparing for that. And, you know, we haven't seen it. I mean, there is definitely remote. It's not as much as we thought it would be. And why is that? It's because people like coming to the office. I mean, they like the social being part. They like, we're social beings, as you said, and they like being a part of something. I think that in the companies that we're working with, I mean, I guess there are some jobs that are truly isolating, like isolated and isolating, I could say, where you know, if you're a software coder and you're living in Denver and your corporation's in Silicon Valley or San Diego or something, I guess, you know, you're not going to be coming to the office. But that's kind of rare. You know, people tend to fly and come, I mean, especially managers. Now, maybe not the employees, but the managers, they're flying to corporate quite a lot. And so you don't. I'm surprised by that in a way, and I could attribute that to that people really want. They do want to be together. So I guess the question is, how does do you think that trend will be like, let's say 10 years from now? You believe that there will be more remote workers?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely are going to be more remote workers. I think the key is to not swing, and it's exactly what we're talking about, Sue. You don't want to swing too much in the other direction. So we had this mandate where everyone had to be in an office from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. You had to be there whether you were doing anything or not. You had to have FaceTime. And now we may be moving a little bit too far in the other direction where we're allowing too much remote work, and people are not, exactly what you're saying, are not getting the interpersonal perks of being around other humans and collaborating in person with other people. And when you look at the research associated with this, we work better in person with other people because we, are social beings. So you can't negate the importance of some of that. So I think, just like with all of this stuff, the key is going to be moderation. It's going to be, all right, well, we're going to be flexible. We're going to let people do what they need to do with their lives. But we're also going to get together either once a week or even if it's once a month. We're not going to have a situation where you might be working with a boss that you've never met and you're never going to meet. It has to happen at some point. Managers really have to facilitate these in-person gatherings, even if they've got a remote workforce. And we are going to want to get on a plane sometimes. I mean, fortunately, I think we're going to see, you mentioned virtual reality, and VR is another area where the technology has been around for quite some time. And it hasn't had the societal uptake, but it's starting. It's actually really starting to move, and I think what we're going to see there, for people who are listening who are familiar with the book and the movie Ready Player One, does a really nice job of exploring what this could mean. And what it could mean is you may not go anywhere, but you are in a virtual world where it feels like you are with other people. So it may not
mean.
It may not mean you are flying across the world in the future. It might mean that you're going to Japan, but virtually. You're going to a Japanese office to learn about how they're doing business there and interacting with Japanese colleagues, but you're doing so virtually. But either way, I think it's going to be necessary to have that engagement, and at the very least virtually, and hopefully we'll continue to prioritize some in-person engagement as well.
Right. So, if you're thinking about like some advice for CEOs, for managers, to think more in this futurist mindset, like what would you suggest that they think about?
Well, the first thing that people have to think about is how it's immediately impacting your business. What are some of the things that are on fire now that you need to think about these trends to address? Because one thing that I see happening a lot is leaders being like, well, this is so far in the future, it's not really going to happen. I need to worry about making my numbers tomorrow. Well, if you've got, and this is just one example of many, if you've got a contract workforce that's 100% redundant, meaning that you've got two people that you're paying to do the exact same job, you are negatively impacting the bottom line. And this is why I recommend a great place for most people to start with this kind of thing is look at the systems you've already got and do an assessment. How effective are those systems? Has something been systematized at all? I mean, you'd be shocked at the number of companies, about 95%, have flex work policies, and only a small handful of those have any kind of flex work policy actually written down. Managers are left to their own discretion to do whatever they want, and they're just waiting to be dinged by the IRS on this because the IRS doesn't like it when things are just completely nebulous and wishy-washy. They like to know what kind of people are holding what jobs. So flex work and contract work are these areas where it's ripe for disaster. So look at things like that that are impacting your business now and pilot some ideas for change. Get a dialogue going within your organization. It's a great idea to just have someone come in and facilitate a dialogue or give some ideas, and then getting leaders thinking about it and getting them implementing things immediately on a small scale. I never recommend that any organization overhaul all of their operations because that's not practical. But choose a small implementation of a new piece of software, for example, that you think will make your job or your department more efficient or more productive, and then see how you're able to roll that out on a wider scale. If you're considering automation, well, do a small pilot. Try automating something. Try getting some people in there to learn that explainer function. Try keeping your humans in the loop to help the business make smarter decisions. But do it on a small basis, be able to prove the business case behind it, and then move ahead. And one thing I tell leaders all the time is don't think you have to be the CEO to make some of this stuff happen. Yes, it's great to have buy-in from the very, very top, but there are so many things you can do to prepare for the future of work by just implementing it on a very small scale within your individual team, and then see how it works out.
Right. You know, when I asked you originally about some of the trends of 20, 25 years from now, you first mentioned this idea of side-by-side humans and artificial intelligence or robots, machines, whatever, working side-by-side. Are there, let's say, two other trends that you could point to that I think would be important for this group to learn, to know about?
Well, we talked about human skills. We talked about technology advances. Mm-hmm. Changing demographics is another one. I think it's important. I actually start Humanity Works with that because I believe that understanding from a global perspective who is available to work and where is an important part of understanding what we're going to be doing in the future workforce. And what we need to understand is that, first of all, the population as a whole is aging because we have the boomers, very large population of boomers who are living much longer and working much longer. So we're going to have to adjust our workforce structures to accommodate for these people who have a tremendous institutional knowledge that we don't just want to lose. Well, right now, most companies, and I have to say, even the most cutting-edge consulting companies, do not know what to do with their retiring partners. And this is very upsetting to me because these people have so much expertise to offer. Just because they don't want to work 70 hours a week as a partner doesn't mean we shouldn't keep them on helping other people and other business units out. So that's something with the boomers. We also have to understand from a demographic perspective where workers are coming from, understanding that in industrialized countries like the U.S. and the U.K., we're seeing our populations mostly growing through immigration, which just means that people are going to come of age having different skill sets than they might have in the past, and that countries like India and China are having their you know, native-born populations growing, so it's the opposite situation, and so they're going to become, in many ways, the leading exporters of qualified technical talent. So if you've been having one of those situations where you want everybody who's working for you to be in your immediate geographic area, you're going to have to become a little bit more flexible in terms of how you're staffing your teams, understanding that a lot of teams will be in the form of swarms, meaning that you don't hire somebody full-time. You hire someone to help solve a specific business problem, and then that team is disbanded once that problem has been addressed. So you're just going to have to become a lot more fluid in your hiring operations, and I think some companies are still resisting that, but this is something that's going to need to happen in the future. So I think demographics are an important trend for us to understand. And then the last thing I would say is career customization. The fact is, if someone is going to work for you full-time, everyone is going to have their own path. There's going to be no such thing as looking at your boss and saying, okay, well, my boss moved from point A to point B to point C, so that's how my career is going to go. Everyone needs to be able to do whatever they want. And the development of cross-functional expertise where people are moving around to all different types of the business is going to become increasingly important because we don't know where our value is truly going to lie. And as we were saying earlier, a lot of stuff's going to start getting automated. So if you're stuck in one narrow area of the business, you're setting yourself up for failure. So we're going to have to facilitate means for people to continuously learn, continuously grow, and move around to have different experiences. And, of course, I think the work-life integration piece of this is really important, where people are, especially the millennials, they're in a sandwich where they're having kids, they're caring for aging parents and grandparents, they want to have a side business, they want to have hobbies, they want to have friends, they want to have it all. And right now, we still expect our people to be 100% devoted to their careers. Well, the millennials don't work like that. They're not going to govern like that. So allowing people to kind of dial up or dial back in their careers, depending on what else is going on in their lives, is a really important thing as part of career customization that we have to keep in mind.
Interesting. This has been great. Thank you so much. Is anyone else, I know you're still on the line, anyone want to ask a question or pipe in here? Give you your last chance. Anybody? Okay. So thank you so much. This has been fascinating world of work. I love this idea of the side-by-side, the human in the loop, explainer, right? And really focusing on the importance of judgment, empathy, creativity. I think it's awesome. So thank you for bringing some of these insights to us. Thanks again, Alexandra. I appreciate you being with us. And I hope we stay in touch. Thanks so much.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me and for a lively discussion. And I look forward to hearing from everybody.
Yeah. Next May 24th at 10 a.m., that's a Friday, we've got Duncan Wardle, who is the former Vice President of Innovation and Creativity at Walt Disney. So that's going to be another interesting conversation. So I want to encourage people to come back and see us next time. Okay, thanks again to everybody on the call and to Alexandra especially. Thank you. Okay. Bye now.
Thanks, Sue. Take care. Bye.